Now, thank you everybody for coming today. And we have this pleasure to have Anders Kreger with us. Today he's curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art Antwerp in Belgium. He is originally from Sweden, but he worked in numerous institutions throughout the world, and he has a really rich experience in politics of representation and contemporary art. Now, it was, you will correct me if there's something else to add, but it was really interesting synchronicity and perhaps a synchronicity that he called 2 weeks ago, my colleague Emilia Epstein. And it was approximately at the same time when we started with this program, Context and Representations in this museum. And actually, Anders remembered this museum from some 10 and more years ago, and this image of the museum stuck with him. And actually, he assigned himself the task of coming here and writing about this museum as one of the editors of the journal After All, yeah. Which is London-based journal. So I will actually let Anders tell you a little bit about the context of his visit.
Yeah, it's very nice to be here. It's the second visit to Belveden, to the museum. I was here in 2001, invited by your colleagues in the museum, Branka and Branko at the time, and also Dejan, to come here and talk to people in the museum. That was the idea, because they had just started their work there. And I also did other things in the city, went around, looked at things, and the image of this blue and green, you know, in the exhibition here sort of stayed with me. I could not completely forget it, and also the fact that the exhibition here, as I understood it then, had not changed since the museum opened. And I understand it's actually true that it hasn't, at least hasn't substantially changed since it opened in 1977. And that, it's just stayed with me as an image and as something that I might one day come back to, if indeed it is still there. Because my interest is not so much the content of the museum, in the sense that I'm absolutely not an expert in African art at all. I'm an art historian, but I did not specialize in this in any way. And in my current position, I am working as curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Antwerp, as Anna said, and that is a museum belonging to the Flemish government in Belgium. So we are a museum that makes exhibitions and collects art. We have a special responsibility to collect Flemish art, but we also collect art from other parts of the world, not as actively as we would want to for financial reasons, but we do have a specific interest in what we call Eurasia, which is basically the former Soviet Union. Not just Russia, but also, for instance, the Central Asian republics. And that is because we have we already have some things in our collection that come from exhibitions that we have organized in collaboration with curators and artists from those countries. So we already have a beginning and something we want to continue. So what I'm doing in the museum is mainly making exhibitions, also thinking about how to develop the collection. And then as part of my job in the museum, I'm also one of the editors of this journal called After All. I don't know if you've seen it, but you can have a look. The two most recent issues are here. And it's a journal that was founded some 12, 13 years ago. One of the founders is Charles Eschy, who is now the director of the Van Abbe Museum in the Netherlands. But at the time he was in Sweden, he was, he's English, but he was in Sweden working for Roseum in Malmö and doing other things too. And, well, it comes out 3 times a year, and our museum is one of the institutions that helps fund and organize the journal. So it means that somebody in the museum is also delegated to be one of the editors. And since my colleague Dieter Ruhlstratte, who was the editor before, left to become chief curator at the, a senior curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago, I took over, and it's been a very pleasant year and a half that I've been doing this. The journal comes out 3 times a year, and it is dedicated to art and context and debate around art. But we try to give particular emphasis to selected artists. So each issue covers four artists that can come from any part of the world. We have a certain responsibility to not go too far away from, let's say, what the international art world recognizes as interesting and important, because we don't want to lose credibility in the so-called mainstream. But what we are doing is we're trying to expand the mainstream, you know, to cover different aspects, different topics in different parts of the world. So, for instance, in these issues, we have material from the Philippines. We have articles about Olga Chernyshova, an artist from Russia. We have a theater group from São Paulo and an artist from Lebanon, Tony Chakar. And that's just these two issues. So we're really trying to sort of have an interesting mix of things from all over the world. And in addition to the presentations of artists, we have what we call contextual essays, which try to say something about the state of contemporary art and the art world and the context for that. But we also have articles that focus on one exhibition, one event, or one institution. And I think that what I'm going to do is the essay I'm going to write will probably be in the third category, something that deals with one particular thing and tries to put it in context. Mm-hmm. In the issue that is now being prepared, we are devoting two essays to the Serbian-born artist Goran Djordjevic, whom I guess you know. And since he is working so much with the idea of display, representation at the museum, I think I came up with this idea because it felt like a good opportunity to revisit this museum when the journal is profiling Goran Djordjevic. There's no direct link. But there is a sort of associative link between what he's doing and what I thought that I might do with this topic. So that's basically why I'm here, to see if my memory of this museum was true, you know, if what I remember is still here, and what I can do in terms of making sense of it, also in conversation with Anna and with Emilia, and also today with you. So I don't think I have so much expertise to offer in what concerns this museum directly, but I have some questions to it, you know, and I have some maybe thoughts about why it might be interesting that we can discuss.
Mm-hmm. I would like to go back to Goran Djordjevic and this representational part of his work and something that you connected with this museum. Because we were talking, of course, a lot about this museum, and in terms of methodology, Andres actually used a lot of this oral, informative way, I mean, to find out from us some things which are perhaps consumed, condensed, and then in a way represented by us. But I think also we gave you different aspects from which you can actually use our experience and actually find those things which are valuable for your research. Mm. And I think I did not influence you in this way, but when you said the museum as an image, it occurred to me that actually the title of my PhD thesis was Museum as an Image of the World, and then you had another explanation what kind of image this is for you, and how does it feel for you?
Yeah, I think it the whole thing started with the question, because and it's a question I think I would ask the director of the museum, anybody who is the director of the museum, and the question is, do you think the museum can change? Is this a museum that can change? I don't know the answer, you know? And it's a complex thing. But what I believe is that if you start changing this museum, if you, for instance, just take everything out and rebuild it completely and put the same things back in a new architecture, in a new display, I don't know what's going to happen, you know, because for me, what makes this museum special is the image you have of it as frozen in time. It is a museum of a museum, you know, and in that sense, that's what I mean when I say it's perhaps more an image of a museum than a museum. And I also think that this image that this museum is or represents is perhaps, in a certain sense, an image that doesn't have so much depth. It's an image that doesn't conceal so much. It seems to be an image that basically shows itself quite thoroughly and doesn't really indicate much more than what you can see. In a certain sense, you can say that the museum is is an image of how it wants to be seen. And I think that's true about many museums, and I think it's true about many things in general. And I don't think it's necessarily a negative thing. I just think that if you have an image that is relatively flat, it is more sensitive to being tampered with and being changed. So I think even small changes to this museum risk killing it. But again, I mean, that might also be true of many, many other things. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering what you think of that approach, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we already had several debates on this topic, what should be done with this museum, and in terms of really this representational thing. And Katarina knows, and Mariana also, through these debates in the Museum of Yugoslav History, because yesterday we went even there. This museum also faced from time to time this question, whether they should change, and then perhaps change this very, very flat, as you say, or perhaps thin representational thing that there is. But also, as you said, it is in a way it is a beautiful image. There is nothing wrong with the image. I mean, the image is beautiful, but then something perhaps substantially is lacking in terms of what the institution would like it to be. I mean, for example, in the context of this museum, I think that at the beginning, this museum was a museum wannabe. I mean, it was in a way. I don't want to denigrate it, but it was without a real content, but wanting to take a shape. And then this shape came out beautifully. But also it is a strange thing, as we were talking, that this exhibition space, this permanent display, was done in 2 weeks. Savet and Slobodan Mažić actually did the design in 2 weeks. And then we were also discussing this catalog for the opening of the museum, and it seems that it was also done in a haste a little bit. And then it coincided with Tito's birthday. Somehow politically it sort of connected itself to like the prevalent ideology. But I mean, only in this representational level, I think it sort of accumulated all the elements, but somehow it did not have this substantial urge to have a perspective where it should go.
Well, I mean, what makes it interesting to visit and interesting to remember and to revisit is the fact that it is an image of how a museum should look like at a certain period of time, you know, like in this case the late 70s. And if you you can compare it, perhaps, and that might be an interesting way to sort of open up the discussion, because if we just say that it's an image, then maybe we can't get any further. There are also other museums that I know of, and many that I don't know, that cannot be changed. You know? So if we established, it's not said anywhere, as far as I know, that this museum has to stay the same. I don't think it's a political decision, or anybody's expressed will that it must not change. But as you know, perhaps, there are certain museums that really cannot change. You know? like the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston, for instance, cannot change because it's written in the will of the donor that nothing can be changed. You know, and that is quite common actually when an artist or collectors donate their collection or their studio space or their living space to the city or to the government, they quite often say specifically that it must stay the same. You know, there is one small museum in Reykjavik in Iceland which is quite fascinating. If you ever go to Iceland, don't miss it. It's called the museum, the Einar Jónsson Museum. Einar Jónsson was a sort of national romantic sculptor. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. Nothing can be changed there. You know, you can't take pictures there. You can't put anything new into it. You can't take anything old out of it. It must stay the same. Of course, if you look at the images of the museum when it was still a studio and when he was still alive, it was basically this bizarre building built on a lava field. You know, Iceland is a lava field. Now, of course, it's a suburb of Reykjavik with trees and other houses. So already that means that it's completely different than it was supposed to be because the environment has changed. But the museum itself is sort of artificially kept static somehow. And then there are other museums that cannot change, not because somebody has said that they cannot change, but if you change them, you destroy them. You know. And again, I'm not sure if that's true about this museum. But it's certainly true about the museum, for instance, in Bucharest, and perhaps you've seen it. It's called the Museum of the Romanian Peasant, Muzeul Țăranului Român. And that was originally a rather traditional ethnographic museum. But after the political changes in Romania, in the around 1990, it was given to a painter, Horia Bernea, who was a good painter of the generation of people born in, I think he was born in the early 30s. And though he was active as a painter from the 60s onwards, and like many Romanian artists of that generation, he reoriented himself in the 80s from a sort of westernizing, progressive, liberal outlook to an actively orthodox worldview. So it was a political statement for people in the 80s in Romania, where the situation, as you know, was very different from here, to sort of become more introspective, to withdraw from public life. And for many, that meant the church, religion. So for them, in the early 90s, there was a whole wave of neo-orthodox artists who were the previously progressive westernizing artists of the 60s generation. Horia Bernea was at the fringe of this movement. He wasn't an extreme representative of it. But what he did is that he took the museum over and he started changing it, and he turned it into his own art installation without throwing out the objects. I mean, he was still exhibiting the collections of the museum, of the ethnographic collections, but he exhibited it as if it was just his own material for his own artworks. So it's a total installation by one person. And he used very ephemeral materials like scotch tape, clear plastic, cheap materials that were available in the 90s in Romania, and created a beautiful thing and very meaningful thing. You know, it was a completely, at the time, topical and meaningful rereading of Romanian history and of Romanian cultural heritage. Mm-hmm. And then he died in the late 90s, or maybe it was in the early 2000s. And the museum is still there as he left it. And it's beginning to fall apart because of the materials he used. And it's also beginning to fall apart because times have changed, and his quite romantic approach to peasant life in Romania might today be read in a different way than it was read in the 90s. You know, in the 90s it was read as a sort of moral resistance to communism. Today it might even be read as obstructionist and reactionary. But what to do with a museum like that was shaped by one person? If you start changing it a little bit, you will probably ruin it as he left it, or you will have to completely reinvent it. Another example of a museum that will probably be ruined when it is changed, but for different reasons, is the Musée du Congo Belge, or Musée de l'Afrique Centrale, in Belgium, in outside of Brussels, in Ter Vuren. Yeah, you've been there.
Yeah.
It's no longer called the Museum of the Belgian Congo, but in fact that's what it is. And it's a fantastic place. And it was built in 1910. So the opening of the museum actually pretty much coincided with the takeover of Congo by the Belgian state. As you remember, the Congo had been the private property of Leopold II. And it was the classic example of how not to do things in terms of colonizing Africa. And the Belgians still believe that when the state took over, they turned it into a model colony. And the museum, as it is now, or as it was before it was closed for renovation a few months ago, still propagated that view, that yes, bad things were done. We're trying to sort of not talk about the bad things, we're trying to talk about the good things we did for the Congolese, which in itself is very problematic. But the museum was also really a museum of what the museum looked like in 1910, and you know, because you've seen it. And now they're closing it to update it, and they say that they're just going to renovate it. But of course, everybody who likes the museum, like me, everybody's afraid that they will ruin it, you know, that they will turn it into a contemporary image of what a museum should be, which then, of course, completely clashes with the image that it created in people's minds during the 100 years of its existence so far. So museums that cannot change or should not change are museums of very different kinds. You know, and I think it's interesting perhaps to discuss with you who know this museum better than I do, where we would put this museum, you know, in that spectrum of museums that will probably suffer from being changed.
Mm. I would just like to add, in terms of the disposition museum today, that there is, like, when I mentioned this synchronicity, that actually in the last 2 or 3 years, and probably in the next couple of years, there is this renewed interest in non-aligned movement, obviously. And we have the exhibition at the Museum of Yugoslav History, Traveling Communique, and we went and visited it.
Yes.
And also one part of it was actually here at the museum, a lecture performance by Branimir Stojanović. And I think, you know, that the idea that this museum did not change is actually what attracts people to it. And two examples that we were talking about, Maya also knows Maya Cilic and Jelena Vesic. We had sort of introduction, so I'm just, because we were talking about you too, that Dejan did, and then Barthélemy Togo did, both of them actually, they used it, this exhibition as an object, as an image.
Yeah.
And also Branimir used it as an image, and a surrealist image. And I wonder whether these interventions would be possible if this image was somehow erased or disturbed. Probably not.
Probably not. But also probably you could not make the same kind of intervention again. And that was what I was asking Dejan Cvetanović the other day. What would he do if he could do something again in this museum? And I said it would probably be quite different, you know, because what he did 10 years ago, this exhibition called, I think it was called White Body,
Black
Masks. Body White Mask, exactly.
You paraphrased Fanon.
Was a sort of quite paradigmatic example of how you infiltrate a museum. You know, you infiltrate a museum by providing a critical component that is kind of there in the museum but needs to be explicated. You know, so you add the explicit critique. That you can read from the exhibition, but if you put a photograph of Tito hunting elephants in Africa on the wall in this museum without removing anything else, you emphasize the critical approach to it, and that's exactly what he did. And he also it's also a paradigmatic example of curatorial research, in the sense that he researched the context of Africa in Yugoslavia to find things that would add a sort of critical depth to this rather flat image that the museum in fact is.
But I don't know, Mariana, if you would agree, because I overheard a little bit your talk, and I know that you said that this museum is this but so much more. And from your point of view, what other sort of emanations of this museum can you propose or perhaps see?
I thought of actually a very different context, or all the changes, or all the stages of this change that happened to the museum and its context, the society, that for me definitely influenced reading and looking at this museum. When you said the first question would be, can this museum change? I totally agree. And then I'm tempted to say yes, because somehow I think that the new generation somehow deserve to get something from this place, from this institution, that they can read. On the other side, I would regret losing this image, and I would be also kind of challenged to think how to keep this image, you know, in what way we can keep it, because it became an artifact itself, right? And obviously it still provokes many different reactions by artists or curators or researchers and so on. But then we have this new, bunch of people that need maybe some new codes to understand, to read, to be provoked, to, you know. So for me, this makes this fantastic challenge for the museum.
That's true, but I mean, what would your what would your program for that new contact between the museum and a new audience be? I would suggest one thing, which is to discuss what the reality was, you know, in terms of contacts between Yugoslavia and the countries represented in the collection, West Africa mostly, but also other African countries. What was the real situation? I mean, what was the? It's something I've been trying to. To gather from conversations here, you know, like what was the real level of contact? Was there any real friendship? And
my best friend when I was 4 was a black boy from my neighborhood whose parents worked in an embassy here in Belgrade, and for me it was the most normal thing in my life. And today so rare to see, African people here.
But I would also like to comment on this, because I think that people who were in Yugoslavia at the time, coming from African countries, they had sort of a niche, a social and a cultural niche, that was created in such a way that we always knew that if you see a black person, it is someone from Africa who is either student or diplomat. So it was like a safe niche. And it has never been contemplated that they will stay here for a longer period of time. And I mean, socially it is something that is still to be explored, you know, how these notions of whiteness and blackness were understood in Yugoslavia at the time. Because, and I think we were talking a little bit about this also, you know, that Yugoslavs also were not, they could not perhaps experience their whiteness in the West sometimes, because they were not white in culturally constructed terms in some of the European countries. But for example, when they would go back to, go to Africa as construction workers or professors or whatever, it depended on their mindset, whether they would accept the roles that were already established there. And take on some sort of privileges that the mere skin color actually offered, or they would, like Oscar de Wijchuk, who wrote this amazing book on Africa in 1961. But he also contemplated this, and he wanted to really divide himself from the whiteness, from the notion of whiteness. And then he would say, if only I could actually wear this the story of my nation on my sleeve, so the Africans could see who I really am. I'm not a colonizer. So I mean, there is so many things to be thought about in terms of friendship, in particular.
I think when you say culturally constructed whiteness, it's important because in the U.S. in the 1880s and 90s. Swedish immigrants were not considered to be white people. The white people were only Anglo-Saxons, and the Swedes were not white, you know, because they did not conform to the norm of how to speak, how to behave, and they lived in favelas. You know, they were poor, and no white person would ever live in such under such conditions. So they were, by definition, by their socioeconomic situation, they were defined as non-whites, you know, completely regardless of their skin color. And this is something that I think, you know, there's this whole field of whiteness studies now for the last 20 years.
Exactly.
And this is whiteness is a very interesting thing. Now you could of course question whether this museum has anything to do with identity politics. For instance, that's another question you could ask about this museum. What do you think?
It has a lot to do with identity politics.
But it does, perhaps, but not...
It was a part of, like, the identity, the political identity of the country at the time. When
that's for sure. That's for sure.
That was one of the, like, it was an exponent of the politics of non-alignment.
But that's not what identity politics normally means, you know, in the discussion about, for instance, art and identity politics. You're absolutely right about that, and that's also what we're talking about, I think, when we say that it's an image, you know, like it's a promotional image, it's a postcard image, you know, of what Yugoslavia wanted to be, perhaps. But I'm wondering if it has anything to do with identity politics in the more widely understood sense, you know, of minorities, differently defined, somehow using culture, mainstream culture, to claw themselves in from the margins, you know, into the center, you know, to somehow conquer the bastions of high culture, which is what identity politics and culture is, and at least in the Anglo-Saxon world, usually refers to, you know, like, and there are different strategies for it, you know, either you set up parallel structures for people of color, as you say, for instance, or it's not just race and nationality, it's also other parameters, or you sort of try to change the whole system to become more inclusive and to sort of gradually make the marked categories of people unmarked and unnoticeable. And that takes some time, but I'm also. My question is more like: Do you think that this museum has anything to do with that process? You know? Is there any such process in this country, for instance? And does it have any?
I think it has anything to do with that? It was more of a private project, actually. It was sort of
It was
Petra's project, and then. For some reasons, and I think that...
Yes, I never think that he thought about Africans, because there wasn't a minority group of Africans at the time, I mean, substantial enough to be important for the society here.
But is there, for instance, any identity politics playing out now in Serbia around the Roma minority?
Of course. Yes. Why would you connect the Roma to the Museum of Africa?
I would connect the idea of identity politics to the Museum of African Art, and just as a question, you know, because in a certain sense, identity politics can only happen, and I don't personally think that it's necessarily a good thing, identity politics. I'm not sure that it ever achieves what it tries to achieve, for instance. But I don't think it plays out if there's no real situation to support it, you know? If there's no presence here of African people of different kinds, then there's also no pressure on the issue of that. But if there's another group of people, you know, towards whom people might have different attitudes, and might be a difficult issue, you know, in society, then that's where identity politics probably happens. You know.
Well, I think that Petra's heart was at the right place, you know, when he was thinking of this museum as a mediator, as sort of culture center. I mean, in these terms, he was quite clear about it, and that was something to be developed, but unfortunately, I think it never developed in this way, you know. But I also think there is a small logical mistake or something to think that, you know, this museum was supposed to... I mean, African arts and the idea of African cultures was absolutely unknown here, unlike in some European countries. So you have to bear in mind this also. You know, it was really a curiosity at its own, you know. And as my colleague Natasha said, it also did not have the approval from the academic and art community here. It was seen as a political project, you know. So all of these things have to be taken into account.
Sure.
But in terms of identity politics, I think that perhaps the idea was right, but the process never evolved. I mean, as many other things, it just never evolved because the main idea of the museum was that the collection was acquired in a very friendly manner and not through conquering these countries, etc. So, and the idea was not just to have a really petrified exhibition, but also to have many lectures and African artists coming to this museum, etc. But I think and that was one of my theses also, you know, that it sort of took some patterns that already were there for museums as institutions, and it never developed its own methodologies, you know, of doing another kind of representation. I don't know, Alexandra, would you agree? I mean, because also you, I know that you had reflections on...
Well, yes, as you mentioned, up until the middle of the 80s, there was a lot of exchange of exhibitions in the old Yugoslavia, and there was like very organized intent in order to bring artists, to bring art from Africa and contemporary artists as well.
Mm.
It's just that at one moment historical conditions put a stop to that. But on another level, well, the process, I think it's latent. It's not, you know, we can't just discard it, because even today we do represent, the museum does represent a kind of a symbol of tolerance, you know, and like the possibility or potential for opening up to other cultures, like openness and tolerance. And in fact, it's one of the things that we state in the mission of the museum.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. But do you think, for example, that there is this real trap, you know, when we go back and think about non-aligned movement and the time? I'm mentioning it because the museum was formed and its collection was formed at the time, you know. When we go back now, I think there is like a tendency to idealize this non-aligned movement now, just because we want to actually extract something that was really, really perhaps interesting and different and constitutive for these Yugoslav identities. And on this wave of Yugoslav identities rethinking, I think perhaps that we are sometimes not critical enough of the very time of non-alignment, and I don't know whether you would agree. Well, I'm looking at you because I know that you're dealing with non-alignment as well. So
yeah, but maybe not in the like a very 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 idealistic manner, and maybe I'm not that much interested in how the substance of non-alignment, all the politics of non-alignment influenced the world image of Yugoslavia. I mean, but I think, I mean, of course, everything that's basically a problem of modernism or modern politics, even like the more progressive forms of and formats of modern politics, it's absolutely inscribed in the entire problem of representation of Africa also in this particular case.
Sure.
But for me, it's a big issue whether identity politics are more progressive than politics of non-alignment in terms of politics.
Absolutely. For me too.
Yeah, because on the other hand, they identity politics develop on the fertile ground of former colonizing countries.
And it's essentializing, and
yeah.
Basically, if you listen to what Alain Badiou is saying, identity is basically the best way to shut down any real exchange between people. To state your identity is to basically make an encounter between two people impossible, you know? Because you've already
borders.
Yeah, you're already defined who you are, or how you want to be seen. So there's no point in trying to meet someone else because no common understanding can emerge from the meeting if both parties have already decided who they are. So I think his critique of identity is quite important, mm-hmm. And I just together with a colleague in the museum organized an exhibition which is called Art After Identity Politics, you know, that brings together works by younger artists from all over the world, and to try and see, you know, how these thoughts about representation and thoughts about becoming less marginal, for instance, are now being reformulated in a much more aesthetically complex and competent way. You know? Like there's this thing called identity art, or maybe it's not called that, but you could call it that. You know?
Yes.
And that is something that we really need to move away from and are moving away from. You know? So the exhibition that we just opened in the museum tries to look at what can replace it. So I'm looking at it from this perspective. You know what? Identity politics for me is something to be quite suspicious of, you know, for
but
what
how,
it does.
What was this like kind of additional plot or kind of new leap into something else for you through this exhibition?
For me it was for me it was mostly personally. It was mostly an attempt at looking at some of the things that younger artists are doing today, you know? And because it's an exhibition, not a book, of course, you know. So for me, it was mostly about trying to see, for instance, how narrative can be condensed into image, you know, how younger artists today. This is a sidetrack, but perhaps interesting. How younger artists today are very conscious of information, how they process information. They're very knowledgeable. And by younger, I mean people in their late 20s, early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Like people born, like, in the exhibition, we have people born in 1990, from 1979 to 1990, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
A few are older, but most are in that time bracket. Most are born in the early 80s. So they're something like almost 20 years younger than me, you know, which was for me very interesting to work with that generation. And they're very aware of information, they know a lot, they know how to process information, but because they do, they're also going further than just retelling what they know. You know, they're not just making narrative videos anymore. They are rather taking this background story and turning it into something else. You know, and maybe a series of paintings that are then presented on a wallpaper that is specifically created for the occasion, for instance. Or they are working with process again, or with social interaction, but based on stories that they can, of course, talk about, you know, and then they can, of course, give references, and they can situate it, and they can contextualize it. But the work itself is not about narrative and context and story. You know? And there's a renewed interest in surrealism as well. There's a renewed interest in the psychological, in the sensorial, in the bizarre, and the absurd. And I mean, there are several things that you could pick out. You know, there's a renewed interest in representations of the body, for instance, as well. You know? And these are all people who are upcoming now, and who are picked up by the gallery system, and who are picked up by us in the museum, and who are now in circulation. You know, are becoming circulated names. You know, and some of them can be inscribed into a rather classical categories of identity politics as people. You know, a lesbian artist from the Philippines. You know, can easily be pinpointed in terms of identity politics, but her art completely doesn't do that. And she absolutely doesn't do that to herself. Because today, the situation for somebody who is from the Philippines, educated in London, moving back to the Philippines, making paintings, yeah, is very different. She can absolutely be part of the mainstream circulation in the art world without having to emigrate.
But don't you think that structurally it's a kind of regression even from the times of identity politics into some kind of culture of Japanese tourist?
I'm not sure.
Like the image without the context.
I'm not
the
sure.
The sensorial without the actual,
it's because it's not without. If it would be probably if it were without, but the thing is, it's not without. You know, it's just communicated in different ways. It's communicated also through participation in circulation. One of the artists in the exhibition is Haegyu Young, whom perhaps you know, who is a Korean artist, slightly older. I mean, born in the early 70s, and she has been quite important in the last years, precisely because what she presents are quite abstract compositions, and she uses Venetian blinds a lot, you know, like the Venetian blind as an object, but also as an image that becomes theatrical, depending on how you show it. And her works can be seen as pure abstractions, but they are almost always inspired by a story, you know, that she can then tell, for instance, or ask someone else to write about, or formulate, or provide in a different format. But it's not necessarily or very rarely explicit in the work. So when you say without, it's not quite true. It's there, but it's not, the work is not about it. It's more, getting away from identity politics is more about getting away from art that is about something. It doesn't mean that you go back to art which is about art. Art about art would be a regression, I agree. And that's a problem always, you know. But I don't think that these people are doing that.
I understood. You say it's a rejection of basically how identity politics appeared in the contemporary art of 90s.
Yes.
As the art that should witness about the context it comes from.
Yes, and it should so represent, and this was a trap, yeah, in my opinion, that quite a few artists from this part of the world also fell into, you know, like you could mention artists from many Eastern European countries who did this kind of art, quite a lot, you know, and still are presenting this kind.
This is not Eastern European country. It is within a discourse of Eastern European art, but it's not Eastern European country, historically speaking.
Well, this is something we were talking about.
That's an interesting problem of identity politics.
Every time that Anders would say, you know, some comparison, for example, of ex-Yugoslavia and now Serbia with some more Eastern European countries, we would all like react to that that is not true. But, well, perhaps it is also a matter of perspective, I don't know.
Well, it's a question of geographic definition. I mean, in a certain sense.
By whom?
By somebody who looks at the map.
The question.
By somebody who looks at the map.
Winners of, yes, of course, contemporary, yeah, politics.
But it's interesting, for instance, yes, that Prague is I think if you look at the map, Prague is more to the west than Stockholm, for instance. Yeah. And yet Czechoslovakia was considered to be part of Eastern Europe. Yeah. So yes, of course, these are contested geographies, of course, and contested definitions, but that's also precisely what this movement away from identity politics in art is about. Mm-hmm. It's precisely about not having to have this discussion every time. You know, it's not. It's about empowering through new strategies, empowering contexts that before, like 10 years before, 15 years before, 20 years before, were considered to be non-participating contexts. And they are now very rapidly acquiring a lot of influence and power. Like if you look at a place like Hong Kong, for instance. Right?
Yeah.
It's artists in Hong Kong are absolutely not making identity art, for instance, you know? Because they are not interested and they have no need to do that.
They don't have to.
They don't have to, but I don't think anyone has to anymore.
That's, I think that's true. I think if you're in a marginalized position, and the identities and identity politics are extremely important to you. I mean, I think that identity politics are something that you have to, especially if you're in a marginalized position, that you can't surpass it until you actually live through it. That's my you have to find your position in an identity under identity politics, and I think it's only a second or third or fifth phase that you grow out of it. I don't know if that's a right term.
You might be right, but you might be right, but it may also be a generational thing. It may also be the case that you can compare it with the development of the mobile telephone network in Africa, for instance. You can leapfrog development with new technology. You don't have to wait for the landline to be installed in Kenya because you can buy a mobile. And there's no need to wait for that, for development to go through all these stages. You know, there are ways of bypassing those stages. And I think that younger people are discovering those ways. And I think that gradually they are discarding this model. You're right, you know, to say what you say, because it's an accepted progression of things. But today, if you look at people who are born in let's say the late 1980s or early 1990s, even some of them are emerging now, like not as students anymore but as artists in their own right, they would not necessarily see that necessity, regardless of where they're from. But that's a hypothesis. I'm not sure that's true about everybody, but I think it's true about enough people today to make a claim that identity politics is perhaps no longer the tool that it used to be, and perhaps no longer necessary. And that's why I brought it up here also, because I was just thinking about it in relation to a completely different project. And I was thinking, you know, to what extent is this museum about identity politics? And then I was thinking about identity politics precisely as this kind of tool that Emilia is talking about. I don't personally really see that connection to this museum, because I see what you said. I see this as an elite project. I see this as a political project. I see this as an official project, you know, a projection of official ideas about identity that may or may not have had any support, you know, in the life of people around the museum. I think it was mostly used, if I look through, you know, what I've been seeing here, catalogs, but also your image archive, for instance, I see it was quite often used as a foil for diplomatic encounters, for instance. You know, visits by heads of state, Kenneth Kaunda, Robert Mugabe come to mind, other people whose faces are less recognizable, you know, who were received in this museum, and it's part of the diplomatic tour, I suppose.
But you know what Mariana said, you know, the context and the context change. And both this museum, Museum of Yugoslav History, became very interesting for artists in the past several years, you know, to work with. It's site-specific or collection-specific, etc. When you said, you know, that one place can be interesting only as many times, you know, for this kind of interventions and perhaps artistic or curatorial.
I don't know that, you know, maybe it can continue to be interesting in new ways for new people.
I mean, even if we see this this museum as an image, I mean, are there ways that we can actually, through these changes of context, really go back to, not in a historical way, to go back what was initially envisaged to be here, but can we actually go back to some systems of value that were at least promoted at the time?
You mean anti-colonialism, as opposed to colonial ways of collecting?
And use this place as a place of memory or remembrance?
Yeah, perhaps, but I think you would also have to do what these people have been doing, who have intervened here already. Mm-hmm. You would have to introduce various levels of critique, you know, of what was actually done in the name of the non-aligned movement and what the non-aligned movement actually did and what it was and what the museum actually also was. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't look past the image or, you know, beyond it or under it or whatever, mm-hmm. probably you won't be able to use it again, you know, for an interesting process. Mm-hmm. I just want to add something about the exhibition that we saw, mm-hmm. A Traveling Communique, because what struck me when I saw the communique that it's based on, which I think was also shown at the Haus der Kultur in der Welt, mm-hmm. in Berlin, the tree. What struck me was how almost abjectly powerless that communique is. You know? What it really communicates is a complete lack of power, you know, to influence the situation that the world was in 1961. You know, you write this letter to His Excellency, to the President of the United States, and you ask the President of the United States to talk to the President of, or Secretary General of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and of course many of the people who signed the document had their own deals with both of these parties that they urged to talk to each other. I mean, Haile Selassie was pretty much an ally of the U.S. for instance. So they would have had their own dealings, and I'm sure that many of these people who came to Belgrade had actually cleared beforehand with the U.S. and Soviet embassies in their countries, you know, what they were going to do here.
Are you a student of Ethiopia?
Yes.
So
my PhD work is actually on a religion object called Tabot. It's a secret object in the churches in Ethiopia. Oh. And I don't know how much of this image of museums, because Haile Selassie and Tito are two tyrants in the old history. And I had one picture of this in Yugoslav archives, Selassie and Tito in the military boat.
Yes.
In Yadra. And that attitude and white gloves and the view of the future, etc., etc., is amazing.
Yeah, these images are very telling, you know. The images of the heads of state, or they were not all heads of state, some of them were representatives of heads of state, are interesting to look at also in the exhibition. But for me, they don't communicate to me, and but this is my personal reading of it, they don't communicate what the exhibition officially on paper communicates that it is about. They communicate something else to me, you know. They communicate as I said, a certain amount of powerlessness, you know, in the fabric of the world as it looked in 1961. But they also communicate a certain lack of empathy with each other, and a certain narcissistic personality disorder that these people quite often have. And I think just by looking at them in the picture when they're standing together, you can sort of see something to the effect of what you're saying. You know, the white, they don't perhaps wear white gloves at that moment, but the white gloves could be there, you know, but because they are really out of touch.
Yes.
In that picture, you know, when they stand together, and they're certainly not friends in the commonly humanly accepted term of friendship. I mean, I don't see that. I see something much more complex coming towards me in that image and in the communique. You know, I see something much less progressive, and something that is much more difficult to romanticize. In fact. And to feel enthusiastic about. I'm still intrigued by the idea of revisiting the non-aligned movement and of making it, you know, a topic for exhibitions and for visual interventions. I think the word research is overused, so I'm not using it, you know. But of other approaches. But I'm also a bit skeptical about the messianistic tone, you know, that this exhibition adopts. Because I don't think that the actual documents that it presents support that. The communique is there for everybody to read, you know, and it doesn't support this, in my opinion.
But in a way, that's exactly what the exhibition shows. It's a state of powerlessness. I'm quite amazed by the fact what happens when you had a big master narrative and then the decline of it.
Yeah.
And actually that's what's demonstrated by the exhibition, even if in the design of it, the very exhibition and the display of it.
Yeah.
And then there is another very sensitive issue that we are overseeing here. There are a couple of them. Mm. One is the belated reception of the identity politics in the Serbian context.
Mm-hmm.
And a different kind of reading of the identity politics in the Serbian context.
Mm-hmm.
And there, the lack of the gap between the research and the implementation of the identity politics in the research of visual arts.
You mean here also in Serbia?
Yeah. We have been affected by the identity politics that came from the West.
Sure, and you have reformulated it for yourselves as well.
Yeah,
Serbian
but
artists have.
Not as we were supposed to do it.
Uh-huh.
And there is another, I mean, we probably because the resources and the funds for the research were not that extensive.
Mm.
And so we were, quite a few researchers here are able to sit and dedicate their time and practice in depth to a certain extent because of some existential issues.
Mm-hmm.
But there is another thing that has happened, which is when you look at the 1961, it was a top-down strategy.
Completely.
But what's happening now, we are the others of the Western Europe still, but we have our own others. So it's the question of the other's other.
Uh-huh.
And that was what the non-alignment movement would have been about. How the others have recognized themselves in the other. But what we are overseeing now is actually the position of the asylum seekers in Serbia who are mainly from Africa.
Uh-huh.
And the impossibility, there is a number of them. I think there are more than 1,000. I don't know what's the exact number, but the number has increased.
Uh-huh.
since the Arab Spring, especially.
Uh-huh.
And they are living around us and with us. But there is, like in every identity issue, in reality, not in the research, there is a strict line.
Sure.
Because identity is based on the differences. So what we are living is the condition of the museum that cannot bridge that gap or does not see the position in communicating to the people who are from Africa because of the social, economical difference.
Because it is and remains, it was and remains probably an elite project, you know.
That's what I'm telling you. Before it was the top down, now the bottom up does not work somehow.
No. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I also think it's telling that identity art, if you like, this particular kind of in its 90s version, let's say, is for me something that I have to say I quite often associate with art from the former Yugoslav republics. I mean, I think many artists in the 90s, late 90s, early 2000s, overdid it, you know, in this field from here. Also artists who, if I can say so, should have known better. You know, they fell into this trap. And I'm sure they're regretting it now, you know, because it became too much of a trademark, you know, and then it's difficult to get out of it. And you can't continue talking about who you are, because then you fall even deeper into the trap of identity politics. And then you have to find something else to do. And, you know, a whole generation of artists sort of leapt onto that, and I can see that they have a problem now. You know? Like even a very dear friend of mine, who is an artist from Budapest, who I think she's an extraordinary, interesting artist. Regardless of some of the problems that she's been facing head on, and that's Rosa El Hassan. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she's to talk in terms of identity politics. She is Hungarian Syrian, which her father is a Syrian doctor. In fact, she grew up in Germany, but you know her. And she is now devoting most of her time to activism, you know, to try and raise awareness of the war in Syria. So she's basically, in a certain sense, left her art behind. She hasn't really, but to some extent she has. And it's a very conscious decision by her to do so. And I think for her it's also very much to do with these issues, you know. I haven't talked to her in maybe a year or two, you know, but then when I did, she was very involved in a project that tried to really constructively involve a group of Roma craftspeople in Hungary, because she designed a range of handbags and laptop bags that were created in this traditional wicker technique that they have in Hungary by these friends of hers in the countryside who were Roma craftspeople, and she was doing that, and she was promoting that through the art systems. She was doing that through exhibitions in Austria and other places, which I found really very interesting. And now, but then after that, she's been mostly, as I said, devoting her time to activism. But she, of course, is somehow also identified with the identity politics of the, excuse me, Eastern European art scene of the 90s and early 2000s, with Milica Tomic, you know, also. Because it's a reality, these things exist, and these people...
I'm Milica Tomic, identity politics school example.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So it is a textbook example of this.
Yeah.
And it is also a textbook example of something that's just difficult to move on from, you know. Once you identify yourself as that, how do you move on, you know, in a constructive way? And that I think is, in a certain sense, also the question we're asking to this museum, you know. Once you identify yourself as an official statement about the ways in which Yugoslavia is better than other countries. I mean, if you look at this thing here, for instance.
Yeah, decent catalogs as well.
Yeah. How do you move on from that, you know?
We don't have the country anymore.
For instance?
We have bigger problems. We don't have the same country. We changed three countries after that. We went to wars.
Yeah.
We are already moved.
It's a difficult thing. Mm.
It is a difficult thing, you know, and it is sort of the icing of the cake, and the cake is no longer there, you know?
Mm.
But the icing is still hanging in the air somehow.
But tell me, do you think, past this image that is, we said, a little bit thin, you know, do you think that it prevents the museum to grow in other directions as well?
It shouldn't, I think. I think it shouldn't.
How can you actually make peace between these two?
Well, I mean, you have a second floor, don't you?
In a way, we do, in a way we don't.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean that you could keep the first floor as it is and redevelop the second floor. and create a two-layered an image with two layers instead of
one on top of the other.
For instance, physically.
And then you get the depth. You don't have the flat, two-dimensional picture.
Wow.
Two levels are deeper than one. No, I mean as a matter of definition. I'm not joking. In fact, you know, I think you could actually. What would I mean? I would really be sad to hear 5 years from now that you're doing what the Musée du Congo Belge are doing now. They're doing it out of sort of officially sanctioned panic, you know, that they're too colonialist still and they need to change. I mean, you talk to them, so you probably know more than me, but well, I've talked to them as well, in fact. So, you know, I mean, they're probably doing it because they feel they have to.
If we can go back to that example, because I wanted to ask you, you mentioned, this is your knowledge, I mean, you told me about this, that they said that this new exhibition, that new permanent display that they're making will actually be a sort of apology of the greatness of the way the colonies were. They kept this story.
No, but until now they did. And I think that that's what they've been really criticized for. I don't know if they care, actually. I don't know if they care, but they have been. I mean, what they did until they closed the museum is that they have tried to add some layers of critique to the basic setup of the museum. The basic setup of the museum, I don't know how many of you have been there, but it's quite fantastic because it's really a diorama kind of museum with beautiful paintings of Congolese landscapes and
people and animals and stuffed animals.
Yes, stuffed animals, but also. Very sort of in the old style pedagogic displays. But it's very beautifully done in its own way, and they're saying that they will not ruin it, but I don't know. But then they added a part of the exhibition that is about how Congo became independent in 1960, you know, and they added interviews, for instance, on video with missionaries who worked in the Congo in the 50s. And of course, they also try to accommodate this as identity politics again in Belgium. This the doubleness, you know, with the French speakers and the Flemish speakers, and in the Congo, the Flemish people were always slightly subordinate to the French speakers. They had a subaltern position within the colonial structure, you know. So they resent that, of course, now. But there's also this. There's the crucial moment, of course. But this is a very specific narrative. But just to explain. The crucial moment is of course this that afternoon in the summer of 1960, I think it was in the summer, when the Belgians were going to give the Congolese their independence. You know, they were just going to make a present of it, which they tried to do, and King Baldwin was there, and he was at the time I think he must have been 30 or something, he was still quite young. And in his white uniform, the one that Luc Tijmans has depicted him in. And he made a speech saying that, more or less, to simplify that, now we make you a present, you know, you get your independence from us, but please feel free to always come back to us for advice. You know, we're still there for you and we will help you as much as we can. So good luck, but come to us if you have any problems. And then while he was making that speech, Patrice Lumumba was rewriting his speech because he was upset by what the king was saying. And then Lumumba makes this famous speech, you know, which is, there's no film of it, but there is apparently there is a tape, a sound tape of it, audio tape, where he basically made a very radical speech talking about colonialism in you know, from the perspective of the colonized. What you did to us, you treated us as children, you treated us as not as humans, and there can be no question of us asking you for help again because you have ruined this whole place for us, basically. I'm simplifying again. The king was so angry that he wanted to leave the Congo even before dinner. He just wanted to get on the plane and go back, and which he didn't do because he was persuaded to still sit through dinner and then go in next morning. And then he had Lumumba killed a year afterwards. That's what this film is about, that Sven Augustin and the Belgian artist has just produced. What they say at in the museum about this is what I'm aiming, coming, the point is, what they say, what the label says because that's the responsibility of the museum, to write the label. And they say, the destabilizing element of the ceremony was Patrice Lumumba. That's what the label says. In the sort of reformed new version of the Musée du Congo Belge, which is no longer called Musée du Congo Belge. And that's what probably they need to get away from. But I'm not sure they understand that this is the problem. You know? Because I think they think that if they just rip out some of the old fixtures, you know, some of the old murals, paint them over, do some things to the museum, make it more pedagogical, user-friendly, that they would have fixed the problem. Whereas actually, to my mind, the problem is more in how they write their labels, you know, and how they present the very complex things today, how they reinterpret them now.
But, I would think also maybe that is actually really a very strong act of maybe aggression is a bit too strong to say, but I mean if you do something like that to a museum that is so such a strong statement of a colonial past, and if you are sort of even, you're not even writing it out completely, it's sort of very, I don't know, you're sort of wiping away certain aspects of it, and I think you are treading on very dangerous ground there, because I think that what you're also pointing out is that the politics haven't changed at all, and they're doing something very politically correct, which is really terrible.
Yeah, I think so. I think what they're doing is that they're not, I don't know exactly what they will do, but I'm afraid that they will kill the image that the museum represents now, you know, that the museum is now, and they will replace it with something that is even more untrue, you know, than this image.
A bigger lie.
Yes, because this image that the museum is now, and your museum too, is an image of the official line when the museum was opened in 1910 and in 1977. This was the official line. Yugoslavia was an anti-colonial country, and this is an anti-colonial museum of African art. That was the official story, and that is something that is valuable now, you know, as the official story of the past, because it helps people to understand how people saw themselves then, I suppose. And if you tamper with that too much, if you sort of take that out of this museum, then I think you would make as big a mistake as they are probably making now in Belgium, you know.
Due to lack of finances, I don't think anything will change here.
Well, I'm wondering if that's the only reason, but that's my question.
No. It's a bit of a joke.
But I know that's true what you're saying, but I'm still really wondering if that's the only reason. I think that there are psychological reasons also for keeping it, as well as I think that there are psychological reasons for keeping the museum open on the 25th of May.
Or the
military museum. Which I haven't visited. Maybe tomorrow. And that's in the Kalemegda.
Yes. Well, Museum of Yugoslav History is a totally different story, and Katarina knows very well that the amount of people coming there is humongous. I mean, it is sometimes a thousand and a half people a day on the best day during summertime. So it is something that people are really interested in. And we cannot compare these two museums in these terms, because you have seen that this museum is not as visited, I mean, not even close.
No.
But also, I don't know if you have seen, but we were together on that new exhibition in the House of Horror, so that museum has changed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in a most, how would I say, fragile point of that institution, which is House of Horror.
Exactly.
Yes. They changed it.
And also after Jovanka's burial there,
I've only seen it now.
Changed.
I haven't seen it before. But Anna explained to me that they took away quite a few of those batons that were there.
Well, I don't think that is the only. But I don't want to go to that example.
Yeah, it is a very, very saturated example.
I just wanted to mention that that is not the same as it
that
was.
That is not the same.
Yes. It is different.
Yes. Okay. Yes. That's an important distinction, because this is pretty much the same, and that one isn't. So would you say that, difficult question, would you say that the museum of the 25th of May...
Museum of Yugoslav History or the building of 25th of May? 25th of May is just one, this big
Sorry,
building.
The Museum of Yugoslav History. So would you say that that's the example to follow, then, to change it?
I really don't. For me, the question is upside down. For me, the role the museum as we see it, of the of specific museum in the community as it is, or as we see it in the future, is the starting point for discussion. Unfortunately, I'm very pragmatic because of the work I do in the museum. So for me, that is the starting point, and then from that point, you can decide in which ways do you deal with what. When I started working in the Museum of Yugoslav History, my first impression was, as you started this conversation, which is that the best thing would be just to put, like, how they say, a big enough glass over it.
Yeah, I understand. Mm-hmm.
But also to preserve not only the walls, but also the relationships between the people and their behavior.
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought that would be the biggest lesson we could get from that museum.
Yeah.
But in a way, it is impossible, because all of those levels that are untouchable, which are the precious, you cannot catch them really, neither through interviews, neither through documents.
No.
You cannot catch them.
Or by just preserving them, you can't.
Well, I couldn't preserve the woman that was practically living in the House of Flowers, and which I caught one day with the wet hair. And I didn't know she exists, so that is something that's very, it's really very difficult to even. And then, as well, she was there the same way she disappeared in a couple of days. Mm. So, in a sense, those are the processes you do not know how to document.
No.
Maybe Katerina, this was artistic intervention.
I would really like it to be. Because it was a life intervention in the.
Artist in residence programs, something like that.
Well, she claimed she was family residence. So.
But this kind of values are kind of, they're kind of original, which is extremely precious. What the threat now is a process of self-colonization. Many theoreticians have spoke about it. It has not been the colonization. People in Southeastern Europe tend to self-colonize themselves with someone else's values.
And in Belgium too, but that's a different story.
That's just the term that one should be aware of. And actually, this kind of situations is extremely. Even if you go to a couple of buildings which belong to the parliament or which are not accessible to the regular audiences, when you see the waiters who are there and the way they act and how they have been educated for the big empire long ago, you don't get these kind of services anywhere else. This is just preserved in the particular time and space. And this, I'm talking about the building of the Federation of ex-Yugoslavia, which is Palace Serbia today. And when you see how the waiters their act, it's a particular embodied agency that tells you that something big was going on in the past. The entropy is going on, actually, because these kind of things, you don't get to see them in the regular places. That's why I'm telling you, that's why the asylum seekers were numerous, because it would have been very difficult to find a black person walking around the city. But now, in the last year, you would see plenty. Mm.
But they're not the Africans that were here in the 70s.
No,
not
but
the kind of same category.
And then there is
that's
a strange situation with the floods. They are the ones who helped out the people who were actually going against them in the villages. Like people who expelled them from the villages, who didn't like against the asylums within the villages.
Yeah.
Now the people from Africa were the ones who were using their body to help the people of Serbia. So there are a couple of very interesting situations even with these floods and the images that you could use for the research with the people from Africa who helped out the Serbs. Yeah.
But I would like just to point out one thing when we were talking about Museum of Yugoslav History and this museum now, that both these institutions are somehow provoking more contemporary issues and questions than any other museum that I know, I mean, apart from the Museum of Contemporary Art. So why this relation and why these particular spaces are so interesting for not only for artists, but also for a certain kind of audience. Does it have something to do with their demise during the 90s and the lack of this nationalistic?
They fall out of the pattern of national, presentation of a national identity, as the other museums mostly do.
Museum of History, for instance.
Museum of History, National Museum, or smaller museums of that kind, or I don't know.
There's an ethnographic
city
museum
and
as well.
So on. So they are outside of this problematic, which is huge problematic, definitely. So somehow, and these museums have actually the problem with this identity, because we still don't know what this identity is, and they struggle with this unknown, expecting it somehow to be given, imposed, drafted by the politics and so on. And these are maybe more related to what is really happening. Somehow have more links with what we all live through as individuals in this specific space and time.
And do you think, for example, that both of these museums, or perhaps, let me say, just this museum, you know, has this sort of discovery moment, you know, for some people? I mean, in terms that the content of the museum is not something that you usually would see. It does not belong to this visual repertoire of
But now
today.
You're talking about an audience that lives here, people who live here.
Yes.
Or foreign audience.
Because, of course, there's a discovery element for a foreign visitor in both museums. That is quite strong.
Yeah, I'm talking about
but
people here.
But you have to come to them. So you have to transfer this message that there is an interesting place. And it's not easy at all. You think it just on the map for a tourist is not enough. So somehow you need this mediator who would somehow show, indicate, this is a place to go and see.
But Museum of Yugoslav History is also not on the list of first attractions in the tourist organization of Belgrade.
No?
And it's the most visited.
The most visited, the only visited.
I don't think museum
military,
is visited.
Military museum.
You think it is only pilgrimage?
I think it's a grave, yes.
It's a grave.
I think that also if you go deeper into also into statistics of how many people come, where do they enter, where do they buy a ticket, where do they come, they are coming. And I think that's also why this comparison is not a fruitful one. It cannot really help
in
analyzing this museum. So
you mean this museum?
Yes, this one. This one comparing with that one, I think that one is
a beast
of its own. So
they're different beasts. But I like what you said, that your first your first idea when you started working at the other museum was to keep it the way it was. But then obviously you drew some other conclusions.
The part of that museum culture that I met there is something that I call the logic of a privatized museum. It was kept as a secret by people who worked there, and they really. They were very protective towards the material in a way that it was not, you could not access it. So, because I wanted to
You mean the gifts now, right?
No, the whole museum, well, let's say that 70% of the assets of the museum are gifts, and 30% were the assets of the Museum of the Revolution who merged with the museum. But everything was from, well, that's how I found it, maybe Polish have a different experience, was totally useless for the people, because it was strongly protected by the curators and people who worked there.
Protected from alternative interpretation?
From access.
From even mere access.
Mere access. Mere visual
even,
access.
Yes, even access and then interpretation. I don't think if that was in their minds something they were afraid of, but they would not really, they were not ready to discuss that. So, if you wanted to, deconstruct that, there are some other things which you even in a physical space have to do. And then it goes. Then it goes one next to another, because you somehow cannot do this without doing the other thing. Even marking the space was a big scandal there, because I wanted to put some sort of guidelines, how do people find what is there. And the people employed in the museum were very strongly offended, because they believed who comes should know. So even those big arrows that you saw, we made them that big so to be offensive to people who work there. Because they claimed if you come there, you should know where the grave is and where the old museum is and where the... Those are the, even some processes that I'm not so proud of.
of testifying on, but that is. So that is when we talk about the state in which you find the museum, unfortunately I have to say that very often I can only talk about here, the result that you find is only the far sign of what the official politics were in different sectors. They are very often the statement of the people that are in, and of course their identity is marked by the community and processes, but it's very often their own initiative.
The people who work in the museum.
Yes.
But that's in a way what I said about the painter in Romania, Horia Bernea, you know, who completely privatized the museum and turned it into his own private art installation, and then it's impossible to do anything because you can only ruin it after that.
This is on one obvious level, but this is on one very subtle level of inter-communal relations.
I see, and it is interesting and problematic because it's well visited. You know? It makes it more.
Yes, it's very difficult also to discuss its content, because whenever you try to be critical about that, the argument of how many people come to visit it is simply. Because that became a new fancy tool, like we have so many visitors, so that that also blocks any further discussion about what that's supposed to be, because there are so many people coming in.
So no criticism is allowed. I mean, if it works like this,
it's fine. No, but right now there are some figures for anyone who wants to do the analysis who would really obviously show. That the museum as such is not such a big attraction, but certain points.
That's what you said. It's not visited. It's just pilgrimaged or whatever. Or maybe it is just
and
curiosity.
It's also very difficult because how can you make an exhibition that would be more popular than Tito's grave? It's unfair task to have. So
it's
almost impossible.
Let me go back to this museum for a moment.
Yeah.
Yes, I think.
Because, no, I mean, this is a really interesting story, and actually I brought it up in the beginning. But I am very interested because you had, and also you had an image of this museum during years, and you had some expectations coming here.
Yeah.
And I'm very interested in a comparison, if you can make, between what you expected and perhaps what changed during your visit. And in which way your text will go, if you can reveal this.
Oh, this I don't know yet. But I think
this is a very naughty question.
Yeah, no, but no. I think of course there is an element of wanting to query or question what makes something frozen in time interesting now. You know, it's a problematic thing. It's not just a kind of tourism. You know, I don't want to produce a piece of travel writing, you know, like saying that there's this place in Belgrade that you can visit that looks the same as when it was open. No, I mean, that wouldn't be worthwhile, I think. But what is it about something frozen in time that makes it relevant? You know, there must be something. I think there is something. I'm trying to figure that out. I'm also trying to figure out what this thing about an institution as an image of an institution means. And I'm not sure I understand what it means. But I think this is a good example of it, but I'm not sure I understand what it means. There are many other examples, but this is one, you know, and this is a rather, you know, thankful one, because it is also a very beautiful image, you know, with the color scheme and the architecture and the design. So that all works in its favor for me. You know, like it's a place worth looking at because it is visually well put together. You know, and that you have to give them, and that they did a good job when they put it together.
But it's also an image of a non-threatening other.
Frozen
image of a distant and non-threatening other.
Are you now meaning the people who made it, or the people who are exhibited through their art?
No, but that's how I see the territory. That's my interpretation of how the territory of the museum. It's a very not naive, but very. What would be the right word?
Simplified.
It's the other. Mm-hmm. No, it's not simplified at all. It's the other.
Far other.
Far other.
Finalized.
But do you mean the Africans or the Yugoslavs when you say the others?
Both. Mm-hmm. Both. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. a good point. Mm.
Remote.
A remote other, even a nostalgic other that can become kitschy in a way, but does not have to become kitschy. I mean, but the museum is much more than that, because there are the attempts to revisit it with contemporary art, and I think that should be the way to do it. If we bring Sven's video in this museum,
which would be very good,
Sara Van Acht,
sure, or Vincent Mason's, for instance, yeah, as well.
So, because there is the funding from the Belgian side to promote this kind of stuff. Yeah, so there are many different, even in the Danish part, they would find a couple of artists who would be.
Yeah.
The reading of their works within this context would become very exciting.
Yes, and for them it would be exciting as well.
Yeah.
But they would, of course, see the Yugoslavia as the other, rather than the Africans represented here. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm sure.
And others, you know. Other, as
yeah,
you said.
But even in the funding, when you look at the Goethe Institute, what the Goethe Institute does now, it's not enough to give the money to the people from Serbia. They're making alliances between people from the North African region and Southeastern Europe. So they're making seminars where they connect people from the North Africa and from the Southeast Europe. And so how, because they would understand each other better, because their cultures are more proximate to each other. It's a very strange situation, how it changes. So people from Serbia go to Algeria because they will meet with people there and then make little projects together, because when they get minor countries, when they get together, they become...
And it's all funded by Germany, because Germany doesn't want to be seen as a country that promotes only itself.
Yeah. So it's a very, but that happened just 1 year ago. So it's a very wise shift that I don't know if many people noticed, but it's a very wise shift. Mm-hmm. And there is this Cimeta Foundation also. They're also connecting the Arab world with Southeastern Europe. So how we are remapping the non-aligned now, or because we're again.
Or whether we should connect it to the non-aligned, or perhaps third worldism?
MENASA region, the Middle East and Northern African region, with Southeast Europe.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. But there were also ties between Algeria, Libya, for instance, and Yugoslavia, no?
Of course. They
were quite active, I guess, no?
Because of the non-aligned movements.
Yes, but the non-aligned...
But with Algeria before.
Also in the 90s.
But even before, the Balkans have been seen and interpreted as part of the Oriental world at some point in history.
Well,
so
the Turks still regard parts of the Balkans as their colonies, for instance.
Yeah, the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, but I mean, they still think of Albania as a Turkish colony.
Yes.
That's what they say. It's nice to go to Albania because it still feels like a Turkish colony. That's what my Turkish friends say.
But you know what says at the entrance of the Native American Museum in Washington? It says something like, they didn't fear the change, they embraced it.
Who?
The Native Americans.
Wow. Tell that to them. You know?
No, but it's in Washington, one of the Smithsonian.
It's called the Museum of the Native American.
Yeah. Like, so it says they didn't force the...
They didn't
fear the change. They embraced it. But who are you to say?
Well, exactly. No, but I mean, these things are complex. And the complexity here is that, like, the country that I come from, Sweden, always also has this idea of itself as better than other countries, you know? Like more democratic, better, particularly in its dealings with Africa, because again, Sweden did not have colonies in Africa, because of course Sweden wanted colonies in Africa but didn't have the power and money to get them. You know? They tried to buy Madagascar from the French and then they failed. Romania also tried to buy Madagascar from the French, by the way. As if Madagascar belonged to the French and they could sell it, but that's another story. So in the 60s, of course, there was a lot of self-congratulatory rhetorics also in Sweden, you know, about development aid. But it was more about development aid, you know, know, like because Sweden was not a member of the non-aligned movement for all kinds of reasons. The main reason being that Sweden was not a neutral country, even if it said it was. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's a different story. But so that there's also a lot of this rhetoric, you know, in Sweden, and that I can somehow recognize here, right? Like this idea of not participating in the slave trade, which is not true about Sweden, and also not having colonies and being sort of a benign power in Africa. I can't recognize that. You know, yes, we're white, but don't think that we are the same kind of people, you know, who colonized you because we're better. That was a very strong narrative in the 70s.
Perhaps that's a good thing to conclude with this anchor, because there is a very interesting inscription, so I'm just inviting whoever hadn't read it before, I think should, because this is actually the first object at the entrance to the museum that states that Yugoslav peoples never participated in slave trade.
Doesn't it even say the peoples of Yugoslav?
The peoples of yeah.
So the Macedonians did not actively promote slave trade. Great, good for them.
Okay, so if you like, we can actually conclude the story.
Do you know some examples from the history of socialist Yugoslavia of promotion of slavery? Or
if I do, mm-hmm. Promotion of slavery.
Yeah, or I mean, because you just said that Macedonians had some ideas.
No, I was just saying that they did not. Because it said here, it says here that they did not participate in the slave trade.
But it would mean that Yugoslavia never participated in colonial world. I mean, this is this kind of statement. If you say we never participated, it means that we have not been part of the world, because, I mean, the world was colonial. So therefore, the dancer Tinovich showed it. Through consuming and other ways of taking part, you were part of this colonial world. I mean, Dinić was in service of Kosta Dinić, the doctor. He was in service of King Leopold.
Yeah, for instance.
And we can go on with these examples. I mean, because we were not out of the world. these parts. So I mean, one has to be very cautious about these things, you know. And I think it was really just ideological narrative, you know, about, you know, because it was so strong, and in each of these catalogs you can read it, you know. I mean, it is just this, like, one sentence that is always promoted as why we are so exceptional, you know. And Sandra is nodding, and I know that she agrees.
I'm laughing, but finished, so, yeah.
No, this is basically it, but please do comment.
Yeah, because the notion of collecting is European, and what we're doing is like part of a very European activity.
In these colonial terms.
It even appeared in a very colonial setting. So.
But also, if you see this first book that the museum published in 1977, it has a little article by Zdravko Pečar in the beginning, where he tells a few anecdotes about how he started his collection. And it's completely the same, what you say, you know? Like, he saved objects that would have been destroyed in the colonial fervor to overcome the past.
Yeah.
He saved a few precious objects. And then he was a drum and something else. And then when he tried to bring them out of the country, a Sorbonne-educated person who was to become the museum director in Guinea tried to prevent him from doing so, because he said this is part of our national heritage, you can't just take it out. And then fortunately Sékou Touré appeared on the scene, and he knew him, and he said that if you're not going to resell this object, it's fine that you bring it back. So this is
it's a construction.
Well, but it's also a pretty standard situation for this kind of Western collecting, no?
But museum discourse is colonial discourse.
Yes.
So
this is the thing. I mean, this is a part of dictum mediumism message. But I think that basically Anna's fantastic book and dissertation actually, I think, rightly intertwines these two and opens up the space in between the clashes of like anti-colonial intent or
yeah.
politics, because
yeah.
you know, like we can't just equalize and say, oh yeah, so there were a little bit of colonial attitude here, you know, like, and compare this with ships full of
of course,
I mean, it is also a kind of relativization, which I think is politically extremely dangerous.
No, but that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm just saying that, yeah.
No,
that
but I think what you were speaking just before was kind of on that line, and I would like to therefore point to what Anna
mm-hmm.
wrote about, when she juxtaposed this kind of colonial actually accumulation of a colonial aesthetic within
yes.
the very logic of a museum, and then in another hand eventually progressive state politics. I mean, non-state politics is progressive anyway, but comparatively, and I like one contemporary text by Rasko Mocnik, Slovenian philosopher, where he says how much of fascism. So it's not just fascism, yes or no. I mean, of course, World War II was a kind of European consensus of European fascists, and everyone could have been recognized in that terms. But it is also very much important of how much
how much colonialism. Perhaps.
For example,
yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
And
no, this is of course. I mean, it's of course probably true what it says here. I can't even judge if it's true. You know what it says on the plaque there. But of course, it's also like it's a pointless truth. No, that's what I meant. You know, like it's true, but it's pointless. And the point of it is to be self-congratulatory, much in the same way as the country I am from was, you know, in the 60s.
But what this self-congratulatory intonation or the culture of slogan serves to, this is also the issue. If it is part of some bigger political game, like the disposition of position of power. An example, you said that non-aligned movement, basically, if we read it from the communique, we precisely face powerlessness.
Yeah, that's one way of reading it.
Yes, one way of reading it. But in Kardel's book, the Historical Roots of Non-Alignment, he says the non-alignment is antithesis to politics of power. So if we can imagine, and because I mean you also refer to Badiou, so I mean we can also accept certain politics as political thinking as well.
Mm.
I mean there is this dirty diplomatic sphere of practice, or what we call real politics, and there is in Badiouvian sense event, and we can say in a way that non-aligned presented event in a Badiouvian sense. And okay, then enter the field of concrete analysis and concrete situation and find the
yeah yeah. But I think that's probably on one level true. But I am just, I guess my question to the material that I see in the museum, you know, is whether it's not true more retrospectively than it was in 1961. I think this idea of seeing the non-aligned as what you just said, a sort of a pronouncement against power, that non-alignment is in a certain sense the antithesis of power politics, is probably a way to look at it now in retrospect.
No, but this is what Kardel wrote, Edward Kardel, you know?
No.
Like important political theorist, diplomat, and politician. I mean, more or less the architect of this specificity of Yugoslav politics, but he reflected on this.
Where was he from? I don't know, I'm sorry.
So from Slovenia. Okay. From Slovenia, I mean, he was a politician from Slovenia, but from Yugoslavia.
Okay. So, and this was his definition of it back then? In 1960-something, 61?
Not in 1960-something, but the year where he wrote this book, Historical Roots of Non-Alignment, which I guess is 75.
Okay.
Maybe 75. So.
Yeah, but that's interesting, because but I have to be honest with you, I think, for me, mm-hmm. it is still, it's interesting that it was written then and not now. But for me, it is still, it doesn't change the essence of the statement for me. But that's me, yeah? When I hear you tell me this. Because for me, it's still part of the self, how should I say, of the self-narration. You know? Mm-hmm. It's still part of narrating something and trying to make sense of it after the fact. Like even if it's closer to the fact than it would have been if it was written now, you know, it is still like
it is retroactive.
Yeah, and I'm not saying it's self-congratulatory necessarily, but it's an attempt at understanding what was happening and dressing it in words that would be meaningful, you know, on a deeper level, and that is very difficult to do in advance. It almost always has to be done retroactively, you know, retrospectively. You know, like when Bergson says that without free will there's no possibility, then he says that what he actually means is that, and he writes that, is that it's only when something has occurred that we understand that it was possible, you know, that it has always been possible, and it will always have been possible, you know, but we only understand possibility when we see it. We can only deal with it retroactively, retrospectively, and I think that this is a case of that, you know, that somebody who probably, I don't know this writer, which is my ignorance, but he probably participated in the process leading up to 61 in one way or another, and then 10 years after, 15 years after, he writes about it in language that is designed to make sense of it. So I don't really see the essential difference between writing it now and writing it in 1975, because in 1975 that was the year of the Helsinki agreement, you know, for instance. So which means that it was already an acceptance of a divided Europe and in a certain sense a divided world through Europe.
What do you think when we are referring to this museum retrospectively, that we are imbuing it with meanings that we want it to have, perhaps?
I think we have to do that, because otherwise we would ignore it completely, and we would not be. If we couldn't do that, there would be no point, you know. And if we didn't do that, we wouldn't be interested in it. Mm. You know, we need to read it from our point of view today, and we need to read it. Not being nostalgic, but trying to understand, you know, why it was created. For me, when I understand that it was created politically, it is not necessarily just the sort of cheap cynicism, you know, of saying, it was a political project. No, it's something else, you know. It's there was apparently the political will to create it, you know, in 1977. And to dress it up in all this rhetoric. There was a political will, and that means something. Also in retrospect, huh?
Did anybody think in terms of emotional economy in this museum? Not in terms of politics, but in terms of emotional economies. Because in the non-aligned movement, people will refer to each other as brothers,
mm-hmm.
often.
Friends,
my African brother.
Usually friends.
But there is a certain emotional economy going around.
Yeah.
Since it's a private.
That is something that you can sense also in the exhibition about the non-aligned.
Traveling communique.
Yeah. But you can also see that in the images that you see from the conference in 61. I think you can also see that the friendship is in a certain sense also a flat image.
It is.
But I'm not saying that in order to sort of debase it. I'm just saying that images are complicated beasts because they say different things, you know, on different levels to different viewers. That's why visual semiotics never worked, for instance. Many people try to work out a system of visual semiotics, but it's destined to fail because images have a much wider bandwidth, simply, you know, they communicate on many levels. But I think the question of emotional economies is quite important, and I'm sure that emotional economy and politics cannot be separate. In this case, and in all cases, I mean, politics is so much about emotional economy, particularly politics of representation. You know, I mean.
But I would like to contextualize it even further. That not only friendship, but solidarity was a very important word of the time, and it also has its roots in anti-colonial struggle, etc. And then I would just like to go back to Françoise Vergès. I don't know if you listened to her lecture. She had the lecture in the scope of traveling communique exhibition.
Yeah. No, you told
and
me.
I'm not sure if I can actually repeat it rightly, but she said that something it like. You have to recognize or admit some level of foreignness to something in order to feel solidarity. And I think in these terms, perhaps this solidarity is much better term, because I think there that was real. But that I don't think it was specific only for Yugoslavia at the time, because there were numerous Westerners, I mean, in a very simple way said Westerners, who were very much engaged in the anti-colonial struggle, and I think perhaps these roots of the solidarity were there.
Well, yeah,
the social and political climate at the time, I think, had potential for very emotional responses to different things regarding human rights and the right to be free and independent, etc.
Well, we also have to remember that the media worked in a different way, you know, back then. It wasn't that censored as it is now. You would actually see images of the Vietnam War. I remember them from my childhood. Mm-hmm. We saw them on television. You probably also, some of you saw them on television. Now there's no question of seeing anything on television anymore. Everything is redacted. You don't get to see anything. You don't actually get to see what's happening in Syria. I think that's a big problem. People don't see it, that they can't respond to something they don't see. You know? But they did respond to the Vietnam War because they saw it. You know? And of course, that those who wage war now, they know that. And that's why they control the imagery, you know, of war, for instance. You know? So I think an emotional response was also, in a certain sense, nurtured by the media in the 60s and 70s. And the media today don't do that. Mm-hmm. So... yeah, that's part of it. And I also think there might be solidarity across time. You know? Like, there might be solidarity, for instance, with the non-aligned movement, and that's probably was my point. You know, I didn't put it well when I said about this thing about Cardell, you know. Mm-hmm. That there is solidarity with the emotional economy, if I collapse your two arguments. This is solidarity with the emotional economy of the non-aligned movement in retrospect. Because we have become foreign to the moment in time when it happened. I think that's something.
Maybe that's actually good interpretation of also what you refer to as eventually idealist part of the intention of this exhibition.
Yes, I mean
traveling communique. I agree with you. I really disliked the fact that they put this image, because this image is okay. Maybe this would be more clear, like for us from local context. For me, this is, you know, like a white angel of non-aligned. I mean, the image. It's kind of.
You mean the image of the heads of state on the
yeah,
drug?
It's a kind of. How to say
this was also local reference. Yeah, white angel.
Maybe the white angel is also a local reference that Anders wouldn't understand.
I don't understand the white angel.
I said that he would not understand, but we will understand it. I mean, kind of like the maybe the most reproduced image, the maybe the most in a way also official image, also the image where which strongly preserves this very concept of representation.
Like
paradigmatic, and I mean, which really preserves this kind of representative politics, like a state.
Yeah, but Bogdana also mentioned that these were despots, and they were, you know, like many of those people in the photograph were nasty people, you know, who had clawed their way to power in the nastiest way possible, you know, for instance, and then once in power continued, you know, so this is something we also should probably remember, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
But I do feel that there is a real, reason. For this solidarity across time with what we can now construct retroactively to be the emotional reasons for the non-aligned movement. There is a reason for that. But there is also reason to, I think, to be careful about the language you use when you describe the project. I mean, that was a remark that I made to you the other day, that I feel that it's too, the language is too hermetic. And I would not, for instance, want to translate into any other language than English this text that's on the wall there for the project. Mm-hmm. Because it plays with language in a way that obfuscates really some of the meanings that the words could have. You know, like it sort of poeticizes the concepts that it uses. In a way that I associate with Goldsmiths College in London, because I have some experience of that. But that's a different thing. But what I'm saying is that the project might be doing itself a disservice by using language in this way. It would probably be better to use language in a more sort of unmarked way, you know, and not poeticize it so much, because I think the emotional content of the idea of looking back at the non-aligned movement would be more strongly communicated with more unmarked language. So less artistic language would be better for the project. But that's my critique of it. You know, that's like as a reader, as a viewer, it's my critique of the project, which stands for me, you know, as a subjective recipient. But I do believe that it's time to take a serious look at what this did. I also think it's very interesting to look at what the non-aligned movement is today, you know, because it still exists, and it has some really strange members, such as Belarus, for instance, which manages to be in a passport union with Russia and be a member of the non-aligned movement at the same time. That's interesting.
But Cold War does not exist any longer.
Well, does it? Not.
Not as an ideological war.
I don't agree, honestly. Look at what's happening now, you know, in the Ukraine.
But talking about just the complexity of all these issues that you mentioned and the Goldsmiths research, the Department for Research, the big print of the Ottoli group we talked about. Actually, I've seen the exhibition about Tagore Post Office, which was in Berlin, which was also done by the Goldsmiths Research Group.
Mm.
And there was also a big print at the beginning, which was by Ottoli Group.
Yeah, well, they're everywhere.
Yeah,
so.
But there is a big problem, because they would represent Tagore there in a classroom, which is inside of a building.
Yeah.
But then, actually, I talked to a person from India,
yeah.
who is an artist from Bangalore, and she told me, this does not work for Tagore. Tagore would teach their students as we are teaching.
I've been to Shantiniketan. It's exactly like this. The only difference is that
that's
the tree is in the middle,
now.
Not behind us.
So people were sitting outside and talking. But when you look at the big print of the Ottoli group at the beginning of the exhibition of Tagore, they would sit within a classroom.
Yeah.
And that's the same thing that has happened with their print here. It's much more complex than that.
But the Ottoli group is one aspect. But then there are also... I mean, there's this general tendency of poeticizing research language, you know, which is a bit It's problematic because it makes it very difficult to interact with the language. I mean, for the show that I just talked about a little bit as a detour, the exhibition that was called Don't You Know Who I Am? Art After Identity Politics, which is up now in our museum. I was working with one artist who is affiliated with Goldsmith, and who is a very good artist, but in my opinion, but I did have a problem with his use of language, you know, and I talked to him about it, because he is affiliated with Goldsmith, and he tries to make
multiple meanings.
No, he tries to protect his language by poeticizing it. In fact, he tries to make it uneditable by someone else by doing this, which is basically withdrawing from communication a little bit. Because one of the points of communication in culture is that, at least as far as I'm concerned, is that the results of your own labor become someone else's material. You know? So the results of what you do are always ready to become material for someone else. And that's the natural way of things in communication, because we need to be able to continue where someone else finishes. And there's never a finished product, because it's always raw material for someone else. And they're trying to sort of protect themselves from that, which I find slightly annoying. But that's, again, critique.
I will not make this any longer. I just want to go back to what Maya said, solidarity, because she mentioned solidarity in another context of asylum seekers.
Yeah.
And I have some to, like, insisting on this word, but I think that that this museum has potential in this way, perhaps, you know, by renewing some values and systems of value. I mean, this is something that perhaps, I don't know if you can see it. I truly believe that all of us are sensing this lack of systems of value in our society, because it dissolved during the years. And I think we are actually looking for models to rebuild it. And when we find something that already exists and perhaps has a, from this standpoint, a positive connotation, then sure, we try to embrace it and perhaps put it in good use.
That's very good. And I think that you have brought up, you know, brought into discussion something that's certainly of importance, you know, like the whole discourse of solidarity has been so absent from public debate since neoliberalism proclaimed itself, you know, the victor, you know, in something like 1989. And it's been an impossible word in mainstream usage, you know, until maybe now, you know, and that's interesting that it can come back, you know. And of course the neoliberals choose to forget that they used solidarity in Poland, you know, as the name for their movement, which was an anti-communist movement, but they use solidarity as the name, and this has been very conveniently ignored, you know, for the last 25 years. So solidarity is one thing, and also identity politics, you know, in its local meaning, because it always needs to have a local meaning, I think, otherwise it's meaningless if it doesn't connect to what's happening here and now. You know, then it's not the tool for anything. And this might be, you know, ways of using your second floor, you know, for something, you know, without ruining the first floor. Because the first floor, I think, provides solidarity across time.
Yes.
As we discussed. I think that's probably the value of it, you know, in fact. It's not nostalgia, it's not just an image, but it's also like a real possibility to sort of put yourself in the position of a person who came here in 1977, because you see the same thing as that person would see. And you read the same language as that person would have read. And that in itself is unique, you know, and something to be quite careful about, I think.
Okay.
Yeah?
Thank you so much, and
thank
everybody
you.
Else.
Very nice to have this conversation with all of you. Thanks.
We will not be clapping to each other. Okay, so I'm so thirsty, and if anybody else is thirsty, we will provide more water over
and
there.
And we can bring it here.
And we can bring it here.
Yeah. But what do you actually think is the future of this? What do you actually think is the future of this revival of the non-aligned?
Which revival?
Well, the project, the traveling communique.
Traveling communique.
Yeah.
I think maybe it's too complex to kind of zip it into. I'm afraid if I zip it in a kind of a past.